The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Mark Garber, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Defining deterrence, the economic sanctions and military strategies that can do most to stabilize the new reality following Russia's annexation of Crimea.
What would LBJ say? 50 years since President Johnson's historic victory for civil rights. Biographer Robert Caro on lessons in political power for today's congressional standoff.
Celebrating Caesar, famed farm workers leader Cesar Chavez is the focus of a new film as his fight for immigration rights goes on, with some new GOP support.
Inside the minds of champions, as basketball's March Madness ends and baseball returns, a new book explores the science of winning and losing.
Songs of Tennessee, Williams that is, a new recording of popular songs the prize-winning playwright wove into so many of his memorable works.
Plus, notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for Your Ears Only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of April 6th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Mark Garber with this quote from the news. For the first time, the Palestinians have something to use against Israel if it does not abide by agreements. That was Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas on breaking his promise not to apply for membership in 15 international conventions and treaties after Israel delayed completing a promised prisoner release, producing another impasse in peace talks. Also last week, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie had to apologize for using the term occupied territories before a pro-Israel Republican group convened by major donor Sheldon Adelson. Now this.
We were happy that yesterday Russia made an announcement. President Putin made the announcement initially that they were going to move a battalion back.
Today we directed our military commanders to develop additional measures to enhance our collective defense and deterrence against any threat of aggression to the alliance.
Despite the promised pullback by one battalion from the Ukraine border that pleased Secretary of State John Kerry at a NATO meeting last week, tens of thousands of Russian troops remained. And NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen declared a ramping up of plans to deter Moscow from annexing more than Crimea for supposed protection of ethnic Russians elsewhere in the region.
But what defines deterrence in this case and in these times so different from the Cold War half a century ago? And how critical are various military and economic approaches? To consider those questions and other international developments of the week, for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Paul Piller, a 28-year CIA veteran, now non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies and the Brookings Institution, and blogger at nationalinterest.org. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Beyond the U.S. and EU economic and travel sanctions that did not prevent Moscow's annexation of Crimea and minor reinforcements of NATO units in the region, what key aspects of cooperation with Russia have been cut or threatened?
There's been very little done that's really key. For the most part, it has been, in effect, to expel Russia from the grouping of advanced countries that has been known as the G8, and to return it to what it used to be until several years ago, the G7, which is the United States, Canada, Japan, and four of the large Western European countries.
What have we seen of Russian reaction that could threaten other areas of mutual interest, from terrorism to nuclear negotiations with Tehran?
Well, not much at all. And fortunately, with regard to the Iran negotiations, there has been no indication of any withdrawal of Russian cooperation in that effort. The deputy foreign minister, although he made a statement a week or so ago, threatening, if you will, to look at Iran as an area where the Russians might push back. In fact, he's been just as cooperative in the last couple of rounds of negotiations as he always has been.
You wrote that many American policy leaders and thinkers seem to have forgotten the Cold War's real lessons of deterrence, especially the limits on threats or actual use of force, most dramatically in opposing communist expansion in Vietnam. Remind us.
In Vietnam, we assembled an army of over 500,000 troops, fought for so long that we sustained over 50,000 combat deaths. But ultimately, what proved to be the difference was that for the North Vietnamese, uniting their country and getting it out from under foreign influence and rule was more important to them than anything that was important to us in Vietnam.
Well, there's also the continuing argument that failing to counter some overseas development we dislike in one place, Syria, for example, actually invites what we see as bad behavior elsewhere, Ukraine, for example.
Well, this has been a subject of some political science research, which has demonstrated that that's simply not the way governments evaluate the credibility of other governments. And I think to understand this, just imagine if the roles were reversed, and we are assessing the credibility of Russia or China or some other power. Would we say that if that other power had pulled back or refrained from a military commitment in some area where its interests were peripheral, that that means they would be any less likely to stick up for their interests where they're really vital? Of course not. And that's not the way people would regard us either.
You also say the threat of coercive action is only a deterrent if both sides understand the specific action that one wants to deter, and also the notion that the promise of no coercive action or relief from coercive action if another nation does do what we want, what you call compellence.
Yes, and the term compellence comes from Thomas Schelling, the distinguished economist who won a Nobel Prize for this kind of work. This is the sort of distinction that we often overlook with regard to those Iran negotiations, where the tendency is to think we have to continually remind the Iranians that we have the ability to punish them more and more. Well, of course, we've been doing that for years, so we don't really need to remind them of that. What is more in short supply is something to persuade the Iranians that if they do what we want, that the sanctions will come off.
While much fictional fodder for his home front was evident in Russian President Putin's speech justifying annexation of Crimea, you found some passages worth taking seriously, most notably what he saw as provocative behavior by Washington and the EU in tying Ukraine closer to the West.
Yes, well, Putin made, unsurprisingly, a lot of rhetorical hay out of comparisons with, say, how the Kosovo situation was handled, which was another situation of a breakaway province where the West not only smiled on this, but used military force to aid it, to break it away from Serbia. Putin also had some lines in there that are rather painful for us to read, but refer to the way we've ignored international law and basically told the United Nations Security Council to take a hike when it wasn't convenient for us to defer to their wishes. He was clearly referring to something like the initiation of the Iraq War.
There was also some inconsistency in the way we cheered the overthrow of a corrupt but democratically elected Ukrainian leader by demonstrations in Kiev and beyond, but not the vote by Crimea's parliament to return its territory to Russia.
Yeah, say what you want about Viktor Yanukovych, who clearly was a corrupt man. The fact is, when he was elected this most recent time, all the international observers concurred that this was a fair democratic election.
Switching subjects, what impact on the long-term prospects for a Mideast peace do you see in Israel's delay on a promised prisoner release, prompting the Palestinians to apply for full status in various international treaties and organizations?
The main fundamental problem here is that basic decisions, especially on the Israeli side, have not been made with regard to what's required in trading land for peace. And although I think Secretary Kerry deserves thanks and congratulations for his enormous efforts, I don't see this process going anywhere anytime soon.
And what is your reaction, Paul, to reports that Washington could sweeten a peace deal or even just continue talks by releasing an American Jew long jailed as an Israeli spy? He's ailing and due for release in a year or so anyway.
Well, it always was a mistake in my judgment to bring Jonathan Pollard into this, partly for what he did, which was one of the biggest cases of espionage ever against the United States. Pollard was motivated by money. He was not anyone's patriot. He was trying to sell secrets to people, not just to the Israelis. And in this particular case, it was even more of a mistake to consider doing that, because you'd have to ask, what are you buying? Not peace, not real progress in negotiations, but merely keeping the Israelis at the table for a few weeks longer. It would have been a big mistake.
Paul Piller is a 28-year CIA veteran, now non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies and the Brookings Institution, and a blogger at nationalinterest.org.
Quote from the news, "We've had a lot of red herrings." That was British oceanographer Simon Boxall after China reported a ping and debris, possibly from the missing Malaysian jetliner, in an area of the Indian Ocean not earlier identified as searchworthy.
Next, lessons from LBJ, 50 years since the historic Civil Rights Act, for your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news, an unstable psychiatric condition. That was Lieutenant General Mark Milley, commander at Fort Hood in Texas, on what records showed about specialist Ivan Lopez, who killed three people and wounded 16 others there before taking his own life. But that information apparently never got to the nearby gun shop where Lopez bought the .45 automatic pistol he used, the same shop that sold the murder weapon used to kill 13 at Fort Hood in 2009. New security measures for military installations announced 2 weeks ago have yet to take effect, and Milley said his base's population of 50,000 makes searching all of them daily unrealistic. Now this.
My fellow Americans, I am about to sign into law the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Its purpose is to promote a more abiding commitment to freedom, a more constant pursuit of justice, and a deeper respect for human dignity.
It has been 50 years since President Lyndon Johnson signed the landmark Civil Rights Act that his political power and skill did so much to pass. The actual anniversary is July 2nd, but this week Johnson's presidential library, family, and friends will mark the episode with a 3-day civil rights summit in Austin, Texas. There's also a new Broadway play about LBJ, All the Way, starring Bryan Cranston of TV's Breaking Bad, and a new History of the Bill by Todd Purdom, An Idea Whose Time Had Come, which takes its title from a key speech about it by Republican Senate giant Everett McKinley Dirksen.
With the politics of our own era so stalled, even over other ideas whose time has come, such as immigration reform, at least according to most polls, it seems appropriate to consider the breakthrough on civil rights half a century ago. And to do that for your ears only, we're joined again by Robert Caro, 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner for The Power Broker, about New York master builder Robert Moses, and the Years of Lyndon Johnson series, currently book 4, The Passage of Power, from Knopf. Welcome back to the program.
It's good to be back.
Now, on civil rights, you've written how his passion was shaped by early years. Remind us how deeply that affected Johnson.
His interest in civil rights started when he was 20 years old. He had to take a year off from college to earn enough money to go on. And during that year, he was a school teacher down in a little town near the Mexican border called Cotulla. He taught the Mexican-American children there. I wrote in my first book, no teacher had ever cared if these kids learned or not. Excuse me. This teacher cared. And he said later when he was president, I swore then, if I ever had the power to help these children, I would use it. Now I have the power and I mean to use it.
I covered Johnson as vice president and remember how big and intimidating he was just shaking my hand. There are also great photos of him getting into the faces of people he was trying to persuade. Were there opponents on civil rights whose positions were as ideological, nearly religious, as we see on the Tea Party right today? And what lessons from LBJ's approach to them?
Well, sure, you know, the South controlled Congress, dominated Congress completely. They had the power. They had it for a quarter of a century. And they were as deeply opposed to civil rights as you can possibly imagine. Johnson had to use such a variety of legislative tactics and so much personal persuasion that you really say his passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was an act, you know, of a talent that's beyond a talent and really justifies the word of genius, political genius.
Well, LBJ framed the bill as a tribute to slain President John Kennedy. How key do you think that was?
Well, that was, you know, that was, of course, important. When he makes his first speech to Congress after the assassination of Kennedy. So this initial wave of sympathy helps get the bill moving again.
The new Purdom book says LBJ showed restraint in some cases as well by not making his pressure for the bill too personal.
Johnson knew, because of his time in the Senate, how deeply the Senate resents presidential interference. He laid out the strategy for passing the bill in the Senate. He implemented a lot of the tactics for the bill in the Senate, but he was careful to do it mainly through the majority whip, Hubert Humphrey. And Johnson, you know, really was a master strategist, but part of his strategy was that his hand would stay hidden.
According to some news reports, this week's Civil Rights Summit in Austin is also meant to shift the public's thinking about Johnson away from the Vietnam War that he seems stuck into escalating, even though recently released phone conversations indicate how it tortured him. How do you see the balance between his domestic achievements and that terrible war?
Well, you know, like everything about Lyndon Johnson, there's a terrible conflict, such a contrast. One moment he's doing something wonderful, the next moment something terrible. Attempts to write the presidency of Lyndon Johnson and de-emphasize Vietnam, in my opinion, just aren't going to work. It was too important an episode in American history. Too many people, you know, we talk now about forces in Iran and Afghanistan of 130,000 men or so. There were almost 600,000 men in Vietnam. The war went on for years. 58,000 Americans were killed. Over 350,000 had serious wounds. I don't think you can erase that from history.
Among LBJ's domestic achievements, of course, were the social and economic programs of the Great Society. But now some critics say they cost the nation more than they cut poverty, making big government itself a target for conservatives today. What's your view on that?
Well, you know, as I said, there are two sides to Lyndon Johnson. I don't agree with that at all. I think that his achievements against poverty and against civil rights reshaped America. I mean, I wrote that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, freed black people. It was Lyndon Johnson who took their hand, led them into the voting booth, and made them part of American political life. His domestic record was as wonderful as Vietnam is controversial.
Well, you've said on this show and many other places, Johnson saying that about the Voting Rights Act later, that if African Americans got the vote, they could fight a wide range of other impediments themselves. How do you think he would react to the way state and local politics and now even the Supreme Court have reversed expansion of minority voting, limiting special hours, gerrymandering districts, weakening requirements for federal approval of voting law changes in those old bastions of discrimination?
I think Lyndon Johnson, being Lyndon Johnson, would react in words that we couldn't print on this program, you know, because Lyndon Johnson understood power. He understood that by giving them the vote, he was giving them power. If he saw what the Supreme Court had done to the Voting Act, the Voting Rights Act that he passed in 1965, he would be reacting in a way to try to get legislation passed that would reverse the Supreme Court's trend, the trend that the Supreme Court is part of.
Let me ask finally, as a scholar of power and politics personally, what do you make of the Supreme Court's latest undermining of campaign finance reforms last week, removing overall limits on how much the rich and already powerful can donate?
I think the overall impact of that is so negative. To allow this almost unfettered, unlimited use of money in politics is the most serious and damaging thing to the democratic principles of America that has happened.
Robert Caro is 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner for The Power Broker, about New York master builder Robert Moses, and The Years of Lyndon Johnson series, currently book 4, The Passage of Power, from Knopf.
Quote from the news, Armageddon has not arrived. That was President Obama touting 7.1 million sign-ups for the Affordable Care Act. Also last week, Democrats claimed to see advantages in the budget proposal released by House Republican leader Paul Ryan, with deep spending cuts in food stamps, education, and moving Medicare toward private insurance.
Next, Celebrating Chavez, the film and fight on immigration reform. For your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Mark Garber with this quote from the news. It's going to be his government to the end, and no one's going to be surprised if it's his government after. That was a former advisor to Afghan President Hamid Karzai on his continuing influence after presidential elections that begin this weekend, preceded by weeks of deadly Taliban attacks, including the murder of one AP journalist and the wounding of another by a police commander providing security for them last Friday. Now this.
Farm workers in Delano, California, have begun an unprecedented strike in the Central Valley. Have you seen the headlines they're getting? That's costing us real money.
You can't oppress someone who's not afraid anymore.
In a powerful convergence of real life, R-E-E-L, and real life, R-E-A-L, the new feature film Cesar Chavez, an American Hero, has opened at a critical time in a fight begun by the founder of the United Farm Workers Union and expanded into an increasingly desperate campaign for immigration reform. Stalled in Congress by conservative Republicans, that campaign now is gaining unexpected support from some powerful California farm owners with longstanding GOP credentials and an unmet need for more labor from south of the border.
But the stalemate in Congress also is undermining the recently growing commitment of Latino voters, a potential problem for Democrats. To talk about the new film, the new politics, and the continuing struggle for your ears only, we're joined now by a man who worked for and succeeded Chavez and married his daughter in between, current UFW President Arturo Rodriguez. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the film. Did you or the union provide any advice or assistance on it?
Well, yes. Paul Chavez, Cesar's middle son, is the president of the Cesar Chavez Foundation, and several of us talked to the director, Diego Luna, the producer, Pablo Cruz, and certainly the scriptwriter, in order to be able to help them and assist them on all the events that transpired back then and give them background information and so forth.
What about the way Michael Peña from End of Watch and Crash plays Chavez, as you knew him, closer than you expected?
Michael, we thought, did an excellent job, really, at portraying Cesar. I mean, at that particular time in his life, there was a lot of resemblances, David, and I think all the actors just were excellent. I mean, they really filled the roles. Certainly America Ferreira with Helen Chavez and Rosario Dawson with Dolores and so many others. They just did an excellent job.
What was the most important factor in the Chavez formula for making farm worker rights a national and moral issue with coast-to-coast boycotts of domestic table grapes, wine, and such?
Cesar was creative, he was innovative, he was willing to take risk, but more important than anything, he just believed. He had a strong belief and faith in farm workers. He has a strong faith, and he believed that, you know, if we work together, that we could come up with solutions and do things differently than what had been done before to bring about success. And so he was just deeply committed towards bringing about this change.
What was the moment of greatest fear as the movement made enemies as well as friends in progress?
Well, I think, you know, always, you know, you have a lot at stake. I mean, Cesar really coming from a farm worker background, what happened to his parents, having to leave Yuma, Arizona, and at a very young age, he really wanted to not fail, as so many other efforts of trying to organize farm workers had failed in the past. And so for him, failure was not something that he was going to accept.
Well, what are the union's biggest victories from the time of Chavez and now under your leadership?
For sure, that first major victory with the table grape growers back then in 1970 sent shockwaves across the agricultural industry and demonstrated to consumers that their participation in this really was and had a major impact on bringing about the success of the victory there for farm workers back then, and the fact that farm workers themselves, if they united, if they came together, if they worked hard and they made sacrifices and did things that they were not accustomed to doing, like going out to these urban communities when they had never been there before, to Chicago, New York, and Dallas, and Miami, and all across the nation, that they could, in fact, be successful. And so I think all of those things, you know, and since then, we've continued to achieve victories. In 1975, we got the first Agricultural Labor Relations Act passed here in the United States, giving farm workers the right to organize. Then, and then there was three different fasts that Cesar did throughout his lifetime. All of those ended in positive results in terms of ending some of the cancer-causing and birth defect-causing chemicals that are used on agricultural products throughout the country. And then what we continue to do today to bring about changes for farm workers, we've had major victories in the vegetable industry, in the dairy industry, the wine grape industry. We have the largest winery here in the country under contract right now. We have the largest winery in the state of Washington under contract. We have one of the major strawberry growers under contract. And we have 75% of the mushroom industry here in the state of California now under contract, where those workers are the best paid farm workers in the United States. And then, of course, our epic battle to be able to once again establish immigration reform for farm workers here in the United States. That takes up a lot of our energy and time and resources, but it's a critical fight because there's such a high percentage of farm workers that are here that do not have legal status in the United States today.
How much influence can Republican growers in need of more labor have on GOP opponents to immigration reform in Congress?
They can have a tremendous impact. Republicans traditionally, or many growers, let's say, traditionally look towards the Republicans for their assistance and help on different types of legislation. So the growers realize that, I mean, we are in a critical state right now here in America, not having access to a legalized workforce. And with the continued enforcement, increased enforcement that's transpired over the years now, growers are very much looking for and determining how they're going to continue to supply the workforce for the future.
Arturo,
and so it has a major impact.
How much evidence do you see of what the New York Times reports is growing disillusionment with both parties among Latino voters, whose growing numbers seem such a powerful factor in everyone's political calculations?
Well, I think there is blame on both sides of the aisle. There's no doubt about it. I mean, people are tired. We've been fighting this fight for the last 14 years now, and it's difficult to continue there when everybody knows the America has said time and again, Americans have said that the majority of them support to fixing the broken immigration system here in our country.
Arturo Rodriguez worked for and succeeded Cesar Chavez as president of the United Farm Workers of America.
Quote from the news, hiding the truth from families that need to know. It's outrageous and needs to stop. That was Missouri's Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill blasting General Motors CEO Mary Barra for failing to provide documents to the family in one of several cases involving failed ignition switches that belatedly led to 6 million recalls.
Next, inside the mind of a champion in sports and beyond, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Brutality that stands in stark contrast to our values as a nation. That was California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, after it voted to have the White House declassify a report on CIA detention and interrogation practices that Amnesty International has called torture and violation of international law. The report says CIA repeatedly exaggerated the program's benefits. Now this.
This was tough. But I'm going to go with the Big Ten. I've got Michigan State going all the way.
And he drives that ball deep to right. And the ball game is over. And Neil Walker gives the Pirates a 1-0 win.
Well, sports fans, President Obama's bracket was most clearly busted when Michigan State lost to UConn 60-54 as the NCAA's March Madness wound down, or built up to the Final Four, which overlapped the restart of Major League Baseball, including Pittsburgh's 1-0 win over Chicago on opening day. With all that excitement on the boards and on the field, what better time to consider a new book about competition in sports, business, diplomacy, and life in general?
It's Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing by Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, who explored brain behavior in earlier books such as Nurture Shock. And to say more about what they've discovered this time for Your Ears Only, Ashley Merriman is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So is winning at least as much about brain power, mental attitude as muscle power or the reflexes that tie the two together?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, before I started writing this book, I thought psychology and physiology, I mean, there was some overlap, but I thought they were separate. And the research actually says that they're not. In fact, psychological changes and psychological states change the underlying physiology, and the physiology changes the psychology. So absolutely, competition is about mental preparation just as much as it is about any level of physicality.
Well, the teases in your press release are so provocative that it makes sense to start by asking about some of them. Talk about testosterone and the neuroscience of mistakes. Is that the single chemical that can predict a winner even before an event begins?
Yes, testosterone does. But what's amazing is that testosterone, you know, I think we all have this idea that testosterone is about aggression. And the research says there's no correlation between aggression and testosterone. Testosterone is the hormone of motivation. When people say, "Ooh, I'm really fired up for this," whether it's a physical contest or a meeting, that's testosterone. And researchers, by measuring testosterone levels, can figure out who's going to win not just boxing, but a chess match, or who's going to score highest on a college science exam based on testosterone before the contest even began. Because that's that body being ready for the challenge, ready for the task to go forward.
And the psychological reality of home field advantage in sport, deal-making, even diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think everybody knows, you know, home field advantage in sports. And, you know, the NBA home team wins about 63% of the time. But what's amazing here is that it's not just I have this, it's not the support of the crowd, it's not the reps are biased, it's this is mine and not yours. And that is almost an instantaneous change. If I get to a video game destination 20 seconds before you do, I'm more likely to win. But it also takes place in a business negotiation. Well, I tell people, ask for a raise in your office, not your boss's, because the person with home field advantage gets 160% more from the negotiation.
What did you find is really required for effective teamwork and how discord can be better than harmony?
Well, everybody talks about the team player, right? But a team player is about someone who's agreeable and doesn't rock the boat, and they're more interested in maintaining the relationship than they are getting the job done. And the research, actually, Richard Hackman, a researcher at Harvard, studied world-class orchestras and found that the better you were on stage, the more discord was off stage because people were arguing about how to do something, how to fight, how to get recognition. And if they were just trying to play nice, it actually backfired. And most people think that performance in a team setting is driven by the relationships, but actually the relationships are really driven by the performance. If I come into your team and say, I'm not happy with how this is turning out, everybody starts arguing. If a boss comes in and says, wow, this is really great, everybody says, well, you know, we got along so well, even though research says that they may have been arguing the entire time.
And in replaying events in one's mind, why is it more valuable to focus on what didn't happen than what did?
Well, the researchers talk about additive versus subtractive thinking. Subtractive thinking is, oh, I missed the meeting because I didn't get there on time. If I'd only gotten there on time, I would have done really well. So the one thing in the world that did happen, your only thing is, gee, I wish I could, you know, have a time machine and change it. The better thing to do is to say, oh, if I had set 5 different alarms on my phone, I would have gotten to the meeting on time. If I thought of different routes to get there, I would have gotten to the meeting on time. So now you're adding different options, and that's going to then help you the next time you have to get someplace on time.
Talk about the big difference between playing to win and playing not to lose.
It's important to know these are not just sports metaphors. I know we'll hear them all this weekend with Final Four, but playing to win is actually an approach where you're focused on the good outcome, and playing not to lose is about preventing the disaster. And if you're playing to win, then you want to focus on the big picture. You want praise on what you're doing right because you want to keep a successful strategy to win. But someone who's playing not to lose wants to hear about mistakes. They want to hear what did they do wrong so they can fix it. They don't want to hear the big picture. They don't want to hear about praise. They want to know about mastering details so they get everything right.
And I think
so it really changes everything.
I think I also read that playing to win means taking more risks, and playing not to lose is a more cautious, by definition, defensive game.
Absolutely, because playing to win is saying, well, this is so great. How could I possibly miss this opportunity? And I have confidence in what I'm doing. And again, not worrying about details, which gives me the courage to take a risk. Whereas playing not to lose is all about the disaster risks would take. So there you're trying to avoid them. And that's why you're looking for all of those things.
Ashley Merriman is co-author with Poe Bronson of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, a new paperback and ebook from 12 publishers.
Quote from the news, thrilled to return to the ballpark this season. That was Liz Feld, president of Autism, speaks after Major League Baseball launched home game events to raise awareness of the condition now affecting one in 68 children, up 78% over 5 years.
Next, Tunes of Tennessee, Williams, that is, from his plays for Your Ears Only.
A last chorus for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
And I'm Mark Garber with this quote from the news. What this means is Paul and I can be married. That was David Letterman joking about his band leader Paul Schaefer after announcing his retirement next year from 3 decades as host of the CBS Late Show. Speculation on replacement includes Comedy Central Stephen Colbert, actor Neil Patrick Harris, and CBS later host Craig Ferguson. Now this.
Say it's only a paper moon. Sailing over a cardboard sea. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
It took 3 veteran showmen to write that tune in 1933. Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg of Over the Rainbow fame and impresario Billy Rose. But the show it was meant for, The Great Magoo, was a flop, and the song didn't get back to Broadway until Tennessee Williams wove it into A Streetcar Named Desire. And that's just one of the songs cited in the iconic playwright's works, now celebrated in an unusual CD from 2-time Tony Award nominee Alison Fraser to be released this week. Tennessee Williams, Words and Music.
The material comes from Ms. Fraser's one-woman show, a Tennessee Williams songbook, which premiered at the Williams Festival at his Columbus, Mississippi birthplace and went on to great acclaim at the Provincetown Williams Festival. Currently starring as Madame Marble in the national tour of Wicked, Fraser also originated the role of Martha in The Secret Garden and Veronica Bailey in the hit web series It Could Be Worse. And she's a professor in the theater department at Fordham University. To talk about all of that for Your Ears Only, we are pleased to have Alison Fraser on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Pleasure to be here.
How did you get started in music and theater?
I started in the National Forensic League in high school. I did a lot of competitive speech work. I was the president of the competitive speech club for 2 years. And the fellow who was the teacher who was the head of the speech club was also very, very clever with shows. So I started getting involved in high school shows. And then I went to Carnegie Mellon. I quit Carnegie Mellon and I came to New York and started working. And my first probably big splash in New York was In Trousers and March of the Falsettas.
And what led you to the idea of a Tennessee Williams songbook?
I was asked to do it by the brilliant David Kaplan, a scholar and director of Tennessee Williams and many, many other playwrights, but specifically Tennessee Williams. He is the curator of the Provincetown Tennessee Williams Festival, and I had pinch hit for somebody who had suddenly opted out of a show 2 years ago. And about 3 months after that, he came to me with the idea of doing a show based on the music that Tennessee Williams chose very specifically to be in his plays.
Let's talk about some of the specific mashups. How does Paper Moon fit into Streetcar?
Blanche is singing Paper Moon, which is all about the need of illusion in a cruel world. She's taking a shower, you know, a rather symbolic shower, trying to get the dirt of her life off of her in addition to the sweat of a hot New Orleans night. And as she is singing about paper moons and the need for, you know, paper lanterns to hide the wrinkles that are coming, Stanley is castigating her to her sister. He's basically tearing that paper lantern off of the light bulb and exposing her for the fraud that she is.
And in what play, in what context, did Williams give us the 1939 hit, If I Didn't Care?
If I Didn't Care, I believe, is from Vu Carré, but we use it as our opener in our show. And what I should do is explain that the show uses the music that Tennessee Williams listened to as a boy and a teen growing up in the South as a lonely gay man. He took great solace in listening to the Victrola, listening to the radio. So he was very emotionally involved with all of these songs that are in his plays. Many of them are used 4 and 5 times. Sweet Leilani, for example, is used in 5 of his plays. So we took If I Didn't Care, which was only used in 1 play, Bucareli, we used this, David and I used this as an invitation to go through the doorway that Tennessee Williams can open for us. If you look at the lyrics of If I Didn't Care, it's very much an invitational song. It's all about questioning. And when a song questions you, you have to answer. You have to be engaged. You have to be compelled.
Well, what about Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Lady? How does that fit into the musical literary picture there?
Sophisticated Lady, again, such a great song. It's the Duke Ellington song that I was very, very scared to do because it's been done so many times by so many brilliant, brilliant vocalists. And then I realized that there was something about it I could bring to our show. At one point, late in the show, my character, my Blanche archetype, gets quite drunk. And Blanche, indeed, is a closet drinker. And Sophisticated Lady, if you listen to it, it can be done in a way that it sounds, especially the bridge, that smoke and drink and never thinking of tomorrow, almost sounds like somebody trying to keep steady on their feet. So we use Sophisticated Lady as a drinking song, really, as a lonely woman drowning her sorrows.
Allison,
that's how it fits into our piece.
Allison Fraser's new CD, Tennessee Williams Words and Music, is due out from Ghostlight Records this week. Check it out at www.sh-k-boom.com/Allison Fraser.
Sophisticated lady, I know you'll miss the love you lost long ago. And when nobody
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, Feedburner.com, and Stitcher.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with intern Sarah Skiermont. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago.
This week, however, because of the most recent multiple murder at Fort Hood, Texas, we go back only to last fall and our talk with a mental health expert after the fatal rampage at another U.S. military facility, the Washington Navy Yard, from our September 22, 2013 broadcast, hosted by Catherine Herzog and me.
Our son, Aaron Alexis, has murdered 12 people and wounded several others. I don't know why he did what he did, and I'll never be able to ask him why.
You're not allowed to just go out and tell the world, hey, the patient has some violent tendencies. You've got to have a more specific target.
Kathleen Alexis of Brooklyn had not spent much time with her son Aaron in recent years, but others had. And while he appeared generally genial, there were episodes of angry violence, gunshots, run-ins with police, and finally the admission in Providence, Rhode Island, that he heard voices and feared that strangers were stalking and targeting him with microwaves. Whatever the ethical consideration of medical specialists in such a case, as noted by retired Army psychiatrist Elspeth Cameron Ritchie, Providence police did report that to the naval base where Alexis worked, though the warning apparently went no higher up the chain of command.
But was there more that others could have seen as serious, or at least troubling, and done something about, perhaps leading to restraint of the man who massacred a dozen at the D.C. Navy Yard last week, or at least to withdrawal of the security clearance that gave him access to the base and the building that became his slaughterhouse? To consider mental health, murder, and related issues, for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Dr. Gregory Jantz, founder of the Center for Counseling and Health Resources Incorporated in Edmonds, Washington, and aplaceofhope.com, ranked number one for treatment of depression in one recent survey. His new book is Turning Your Down Into Up. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you.
In the previous segment, we talked about the failings of the military's security and security clearance systems, including failure to act on the soon-to-be shooter's complaint about hearing voices and being microwaved. If he had said something similar to a family member, friend, or colleague, what action would you recommend?
Well, this is where you've got to trust that intuition. Too often in these situations, we hear people say, I wish I would have. I knew something was wrong. I wish I would have listened to myself. That's what I want you to do. When you hear something that is so out of the ordinary and a person hearing voices, now we know, and let me disqualify, that the majority of people with mental illness are not violent. And in fact, they tend to be more victimized, if anything. But we have situations where if a person feels and they're delusional, and they feel as though somebody's after them, and they have to respond to it. You know, that's where you cross the line. I'm being tormented. There's somebody after me. I have to respond. When you hear language like that, boy, that's a warning sign.
What is required legally to have a relative or a non-relative committed for observation or at least considered for such commitment?
Well, we have these different mental health laws from state to state, but what we do know is if you suspect that there could be a potential for violence or your life or somebody else's life is endangered, we're going to always err on the side of safety. And so your obligation is to pick up the phone, is to report your concerns, go on record with that, particularly if we know the individual or have had experience with the individual and we've seen a pattern of, we'll call it erratic behavior, pattern of mental illness, and you begin to hear this person saying different things where it's escalating, please trust yourself.
In the Fort Hood shooting, we've seen that an American Muslim was willing to die for what he felt were valid religious principles. Would you guess that the Navy Yard shooter was targeting what he perceived as enemies or symbols of his enemies? Or was he to some degree seeking suicide by military police to end his psychic pain?
It could go both ways, but one thing to look at is if they feel a sense of persecution, so I'm being persecuted, and I need to respond to that persecution to save either myself or the perception is I'm saving others.
In our new information age, mental health problems, far short of an insanity conviction in a court, could be added to personal records, personnel records that feed into databanks for gun purchasers. How far down the ladder do you think it might be practical and useful to go?
Well, I'm for the one for protecting lives and erring again on the side of safety. If you're dealing with a person that's got long-term historic depression, and, you know, they go in and try to purchase a gun, for example, would that be good to know that this person has had chronic depression? We're seeing too many situations like this where a person over time decided in the depths of despair and depression to end their life. And I'm going to be one that's going to crusade for saving that life.
Beyond better reading of red flags for prevention of violence, what sort of treatment would you be comfortable seeing to minimize the chance of violence short of incarceration or commitment?
Well, this is a wonderful question to look at because we have too many people right now who really are struggling with mental illness who end up on the streets. They end up homeless. These people end up in a situation where they are not getting the help they need. You know, many times, you know, we have resources with medication, but they're not getting the resources that are available.
Moving to the survivors of the Navy Yard shooting, next of kin of the victims there and of the dozen slain days later in a Chicago gang massacre, what are the first few steps or stages for moving forward for them?
Well, you know, the first thing, this is so traumatic and so shocking and so unreal. as we just begin to work through the grief. And so we've got the shock of it. And as we begin to look at people who they may have known, how it affects family. So there's just the processing of this. And so we need help doing that. We need help. One of the dangers is in this complex grief that we're experiencing, we may end up becoming self-destructive to our own selves. We get into despair. We get into depression. We may end up self-medicating. We may try to numb ourselves through alcohol or drugs. And we need to be aware of that and the secondary effects of this.
How common is it for next of kin in these mass shootings or any shootings to become crusaders for gun control or other aspects of gun safety? And is living with the issue a way of healing?
You know, I think it can be a way of healing. I think more often what we see is individuals fall more on that depression side and they feel helpless and hopeless.
Dr. Gregory Jantz is founder of the Center for Counseling and Health Resources Incorporated in Edmonds, Washington, and aplaceofhope.com, ranked number one for treatment of depression in one recent survey. His new book is Turning Your Down Into Up.
Mental Health and Mass Murder, from our September 22, 2013 broadcast. Following an official review that found troubling gaps in Navy Yard security, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel 2 weeks ago announced new measures to protect service members and civilian employees, but they have not yet become operational.
The following week, both houses of Congress adopted a measure expanding outpatient mental health treatment, but disagreement continues over more comprehensive legislation with bipartisan support, the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act. It includes more funds for suicide prevention programs and therapy by telephone or video, but also expanded use of involuntary outpatient treatment. This becomes a civil rights issue quickly and can drive people away from seeking services, warned Gina Nickel, head of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now Alison Fraser again with a Noel Coward number sung in Clothes for a Summer Hotel, the last Tennessee Williams play to open on Broadway.
The party's over now. The dawn is drawing very nigh. The candles gutter. The starlight leaves the sky. It's time for little boys and girls to hurry home to bed, for there's a new day waiting just ahead. Life is sweet, but time is fleet beneath the magic of the moon. Dancing time may seem sublime, but it is ended all too soon. The thrill is gone, to linger on would spoil it anyhow. Let's creep away from the day, for the party's over now. Night is over, dawn is breaking. Everywhere the town is waking, just as we are headed off to sleep.